You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, I'm Vulture Senior Editor Jesse David Fox, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. Honestly, usually, it's about more than a joke. It's about comedy broadly. It's about people specifically. But sometimes it really is about a joke, especially when you got a joke like this week's, as our guest is New York stand-up comedian Shane Torres, and his joke about Guy Fieri is, at least in my opinion, one of the best of the last, decade. If you've not heard the joke, you might know it from Patton Oswalt on this show twice, saying it is the joke he wished he wrote. Besides being so funny, it really shows the power of comedy. You know, it was an idea where everyone was zigging and like describing Guy Fieri as like the worst person that ever existed. And Shane found an angle by zagging and be like, maybe this guy's not so bad. And like instantly when he tells this joke, you can see an audience like laugh in a way where like it feels like they breathe for the first time. Like there's like, oh yeah. Like it's like he lifted the wool over people's eyes in a way that comedy can do and often is considered doing for like serious subjects. But you know, he did it for Guy Fieri. And I knew it from the first time I saw it. Seeing Shane open for Kyle Kinane in the fall of 2016. Instantly when the joke was finished, I was like, this is going to be huge. It's a feeling I don't have often. I after show, I literally sent myself an email as a reminder that whenever Shane releases an album, to try to have Vulture premiere this track. And we did. It was in August 2017. And it blew up. Like, in a way, I've seen very few jokes ever do. You know, we wrote about it, people were sharing it, and then other people were sharing it, and other people wrote about it. It was like one of my great days as a comedy fan on the internet. The version of the joke we're going to play was its final form as he did it on Conan in September of 2017. Anthony Bourdain plays a role in the jokes, so I should note that this was recorded before he committed suicide. If some of what Shane says is hard to hear, just think it's more about the idea of Anthony Bourdain than the actual guy. I'll also say, in case you're thinking, well, everybody loves Guy Fieri. As a person who was very much on the internet in 2017, I can say that was not the case then. This joke, I believe, is the reason for the shift. So, here is Shane Torres.
Can someone please explain to me what the hell Guy Fieri ever did to anyone? Y'all know who I'm talking about, the celebrity chef? People shit on that dude all the time. And as far as I can tell, all he ever did was follow his dreams. do you understand? People are horrible to a television personality, and he didn't do anything wrong. Here's what he did do, America. He started a company where he hires everybody. He pays more than minimum wage. He gives health benefits before he has to. He has a nonprofit where he gives pretzel-making machines to schools so they can fundraise. I know that one sounds like I made it up, but I swear to Christ, it's true. He works with Special Olympics athletes, and if you need a little more sugar with this medicine, he also officiated a gay wedding. Yeah. But because he has flames on his shirt, everybody shits all over this dude like he's a member of Nickelback. And by the way, what the hell did Nickelback ever do? They made 40 million bros happy? Yeah, you don't want them walking around pissed off. That's how we ended up in this mess. That should bother all of you. And look, I get it. I don't want to hang out with Guy Fieri either, okay? I know he looks like a Hot Topic manager moonlighting out of Fridays. But he didn't do anything wrong. Well, what else has he done, Shane? I'm so glad you asked. He goes around the country to small businesses and gives them free advertising on a national platform on a weekly basis. Advertising those small businesses could never afford themselves with his own television show. But because his hair looks like he was electrocuted while drinking Mountain Dew, people act like we need to saw his head off and put it on the internet. Meanwhile, y'all can't get enough of Anthony Bourdain. And he seems like the kind of dude that would be mean to dogs. So I don't understand what is happening. What does he do? So I put on Rolling Stones t-shirts and I tell food courts they suck. Come on, man. Like, if you had to choose between being stuck in a foxhole with Anthony Bourdain or Guy Fieri, you're going to pick Fieri every time. I am still doing this bit. What's Bourdain going to do? I'll tell you. It'll be like that dude in every World War II movie who sucks the whole time. Then when the Nazis show up, doesn't do his job, gets a bunch of good soldiers killed. Meanwhile, Guy Fieri's over here earning new nicknames like El Fuego. Picking up live grenades, throwing them back, saying dope shit like welcome to Flavortown. And he knows he's dying on that beach in France that morning, but he's there fighting. And what do y'all do? You shit all over him just because he had his sunglasses on the back of his neck. I think it's awesome that he has a racing stripe painted on his fridge. Love it if Banksy had painted it. And look, guys, I know I look like the kind of dude that would defend Guy Fieri. But if that's what you're taking away from this, you're missing the point. Thank you guys very much. I'm Shane Torres. Really appreciate it.
I am here with the comedian behind the joke you just heard, Shane Torres. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, man.
This is a long time coming for me. I feel like when I thought of doing this show, I was like, well, one day I'll have Shane on to talk about this joke. And today is that day. So let's start from the beginning. Before even the joke was a flicker in your eye, what was your relationship to Guy Fieri?
Truthfully, there wasn't one. I would say my relationship was like I absorbed him like a lot of people do, kind of in background, for lack of a better, you know, like he's kind of always on TV or he's always on the gym television or wherever you're running, you know? So I knew who he was. He was this kind of wild and crazy looking dude. But other than that, I had no knowledge outside of the show itself. You know, I wasn't an avid watcher.
So then what set you off to be like, maybe there's something here?
Well,
I would go to like shows and everybody had like a shitty joke about him, or he was like a referential. He like, which I thought was kind of amazing that he was a reference all the time. You know, it's always like, is like Guy Fieri, blah, 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 reading, you know, Marcel Proust or something, whatever, what kind of like hip hop comic wants to like reference, you know, like, I just don't get it, you know, or whatever. But so it was kind of like, well, like, I guess what I was saying, all the jokes were, well, not actually saying the same words were the exact same joke.
Yes.
That's kind of where it started. I was like, and I never wanted to tell a joke that somebody else could tell.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that was kind of where it started.
Where you saw people doing it, and knowing that people were doing it all one angle, you're like, oh, if I do the opposite angle, it's like all mine.
Yeah, kind of. I thought it was just easy. And I thought, well, like, what's the other side of it? You know, like, I guess I'm of the impression the first thing that comes to your mind in a joke or an angle on a joke shouldn't be the finished product of it, which I think is what a lot of that was in reference to Guy Fieri is, you know, the king of hot dogs or whatever fucking assholes wanted to say about him.
Yeah. So walk me through then, you have this feeling of like, oh, there's an area here where people aren't doing anything, to going on stage with something. You know, how much did you go on stage with? What was your process to sort of have something, you know, what were you thinking when you're like, oh, what is my ankle? Sort of like walk me through the sort of thought process to the point where you sort of got on stage the first time.
I actually remember it kind of, yeah, like pretty vividly, honestly, because I was kind of thinking on it and just doing the coffee shop thing. And where you just kind of sit in a coffee shop for 4 hours after you buy one cup of coffee. And then I would like just kind of like read and like go over the stuff, use the bathroom tent. Like I looked homeless. But I don't know if you know Jeremy Levenbach.
It sounds familiar.
He used to book Whiplash when that was the show.
Yes.
Yeah. And Jeremy's a buddy of mine. He's like, do you want to do Whiplash tonight? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, I'd done it a few times and I'd done well on it, but I was like, I had to bring some new heat. And I was like, I guess I'll just try this. And I was thinking about what if the angle and the bit is that he literally hasn't done anything wrong. Like that's kind of where the bit, like I went up and I was just like, and it was like, it was at first, it was just a one liner where I just go, like, I would come out and I guess I kept this part of the bit. Can someone please explain to me, what the fuck Guy Fieri ever did to anyone? And there was kind of this chuckle. And then I was like, and then the line was like, because as far as I can tell, all he ever did was follow his dreams. And then it got a huge pop.
Yeah.
And then like there was kind of this, if I don't know if this is true or I'm, you know, blowing smoke up my own ass, but I felt like they wanted more of it. Like, and I was like, okay, I have to go write this joke.
So, it's like mid-set, you're like, oh, I gotta go.
It was like, don't worry, Apatow's up next. Which is actually what happened. I left a turd in the punch bowl for the Hollywood's biggest director to pick up. That's how it actually, the first time it started, because I was like, oh, there's more to it.
Yeah. So was the next step doing research, or you're like, oh, let me actually find out more about this person? Was that what your thinking was? Like, I feel like there is a version where you just sort of like talk about even just the idea of him and be like, yeah, this seems fine. But like, what made you go like, I'm going to do research? And then what was it like doing that research?
The information I do in the bit, or I give out in the bit, unfolded rather quickly. You know, like if you Google Guy Fieri, you're just going to be like, it won't end. There's no, like, more information about him will be uploaded to the internet in a day than you can get through in a lifetime.
Yeah. So then you're like, you're picking and choosing from the list of good deeds. And then I imagine when you found that pretzel making thing, you're like, well, that is already as if someone wrote the joke for me.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
The thing that I found, I sort of like did your research. I just want to see like more information. And because the gay wedding one, I mean, as I'm sure you know, it's not like he officiated one gay wedding.
Yeah, it wasn't his cousin who he's always been close to, you know?
He officiated 101 gay weddings in tribute to his sister who was a lesbian who passed away. Like, it's like, not like, can you talk about the decision not to, like, give all the information about that gay wedding? Or you're like, this is enough.
Well, truly, I didn't know. I had heard his sister was gay, but I didn't know she had passed away. I guess I missed that part or glanced over it. But I do want to point out that, like, it's so funny. It's such a Guy Fieri thing for him to do 101 and not just 100. it's like what a menu description in one of his restaurants or something. It's 101 wing tower, not 100. But I guess the thing with not giving all the information about it is I think part of it was just word economy and efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And then part of it is like, I don't want to ruin the mood of the joke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if I don't really recall that about his sister, but if that's the case, I don't know if I would want to put it in anyway, you know, like when I'm trying to highlight what a good person is and then marking them like what probably is a pretty great personal tragedy to him.
Yeah. I think also, and I was going to ask you, which is like this is like the part of the joke, especially when you're just listing things where it's not even like there's a punchline where like, it's almost like the goal is to like pace up the ranting of it, right? You start off real slow. You're just sort of like, tell me. And then like, what did Guy Fieri do to Fieri did to anybody? And then you just let the audience, like, it's like they snap out of this life of like assuming this guy was bad and like, and then you sort of like need to ramp up the pace. Are you deliberate about thinking about
that's
like
the design and the joke itself to like go on a run there a little bit, like, and to become a little bit more feverish feeling as the listings go on, of his good deeds. Mm-hmm. The joke is written in a way like, okay, it's slow. Let's introduce this concept that seems like, you know, trying to explain like blockchain to people or, you know, like, and they're like, ah, I think I kind of get what he's saying. And then like really hammering them for a little bit with it. So I don't want them to dissent from it. The idea, like, it's all based on it's all predicated on the idea that he is a decent man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's getting everyone on board as fast as possible. And now we're having a party with like, it's, everyone's in on this thing.
Yes. Yeah. I don't do the bit anymore, but I can feel the room snap into place sometimes when I was doing it. And then like really like kind of roller coastering them up with the bit, I guess. It was such an exciting joke when I was really into it, you know, like for me to be like, all right, you motherfuckers, somebody's coming to flop his big, big joke on the table.
So the Nickelback joke part of it, I heard an earlier version of the joke on the Keep Your Hands Together podcast. And what I was surprised, which it was like, it goes like everybody shits all over him like he's a member of Nickelback. And that's where it ended. But by the time you record the album, there's the tag of like, and by the way, what the hell did Nickelback ever do? And then months later, you then have the other one of like, where you now are defending Nickelback, which is like they made 40 million bros happy. You don't want them pissed off. Like, can you talk about that part? That's part, like, at least from what I noticed, is like changed pretty noticeably. Can you talk about that part evolving?
Yeah. That is like, okay, well, if I shit on Nickelback, who also has apparently done nothing wrong that I know of, I didn't research them as much because I was afraid like what kind of person I might, just be like a walking Spencer's Gifts if I'm just walking around defending Guy Fieri and Nickelback. But I get like, one, it's the way I work. Like when I write a joke, I'm always kind of kneading and massaging the dough of the joke. So for me, it's like, this can change. This word can change. Maybe this has got room for a tag in it. Maybe it's too much. Maybe I should take that out. I have a lot of chipping away and adding. So I think that's probably part of the reason that little bit of the joke changed. But then also it seemed to make more sense to defend them as well.
in the concept of the joke and of its nature's in the nature of it itself. Yeah.
Yeah, because they, I mean, like, it's a, you're finding more examples of, like, whatever, like, this definition of, like, bad taste is, you're just sort of, like, holding that up to people of, like, why have we, like, put a moral judgment on taste?
Yeah, it's not even a moral judgment on taste. It's the position of, like, being negative, like, at some point became a valid opinion without having any support for it. And I think I've said that before, but the culture, I really think, like, people just, there was this time, and maybe the world is getting better, who fucking knows, but where everything, it was just fashionable to shit on stuff, and it was, like, weak writing, and it wasn't even criticism, it was, like, heckling via, you know, a BuzzFeed list or whatever. So I really hated that. And I'm a person who doesn't like a lot of things. I don't like the dismissal of things without any support of it. Yeah. For your reason of dismissal. Yeah.
It also reminds me of a couple things, which is sort of like Patton Oswalt has this thing of, like, it's funnier to come from a position of, like, things you love or what you love about something, or even if you don't like something, like, what do you love about this thing you don't like, opposed to just sort of, like, piling on negative things. And I think it was a matter of coming through a topic from a perspective of love or wonder, opposed to sort of cynicism, which it gets boring. I mean, I think that's ultimately, especially over the course of a show, if everyone's doing it, you're just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's a completely exhausting thing to hear for too long. I feel like it puts the crowd in a position like they're being scolded or something. They don't feel bad and maybe they laugh, but it's just like very few people can be like negative and shit all over something and still like not make you feel horrible and laugh your ass off. Like there's like, I think like Ben Roy does it well and a couple other people, but it's too easy to just dog something out and shit all over it for it to be good most of the time.
I also think you learn more about a person from the things that seem meaningful to them than the things they don't like and truly they spend no time thinking about.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's like why would you want to hear someone talk about something they don't give a fuck about? Patton has that great bit about the new Star Wars movies when they came out and how disappointed he was in them, where he talked about like, they show a little bit of the Death Star at the end. And he's like, you could tell how invested he is emotionally in those movies they mean to him. You know, and I thought his name was Hans Solo until like 2 years ago. So like, I really don't give a shit about Star Wars, but I remember losing my fucking mind laughing to that bit of Patton's. And so like, I mean, yeah, like I think it's always better to come from a place of love.
In the Conan joke after this part, you take a big pause. Is that an intentional pause to catch people up, or I couldn't tell if you maybe forgot your place in the joke.
I didn't forget my place. Like I had the joke tattooed on the inside of my eyelids. Yeah. I kind of was like hoping for more, you know, from the audience. I haven't watched it since it aired that night. I don't think I have. What if I was the one that gave me like 8 million views on this? I just had it on repeat. But I remember because like I used to pause there and kind of like put my arms up in like a very Lewis Black kind of manner of like, I'm so frustrated, you know, like, and I think maybe on Conan, I know I was doing it eventually. I was like, I say, that should bother you. And I don't know if I did it on Conan, but it really should bother people.
Yeah, talk about that. I thought it's an interesting thing to tell people, like, this is a problem that this person did nothing wrong and we are mad at him. What was your thinking by that?
Yeah. Have you ever been in a fight with someone who accused you of doing something you didn't do?
Yeah.
It's fucking infuriating, man. I have like been accused of things that I have not done by like family members or brother, you know, or whomever, and like move me to, not because I am sad, but literal anger tears. And this is like another thing like that. It's so
it's not that people making fun of him are bad people, but they're not taking the time to be a good person either in this situation.
Do you feel like you're a justice-oriented person? Do you feel like justice matters to you?
Yes. Yeah, I think I spent... yes, I do. So the past 4 years have been pretty hard for me. I do. I don't always do what's right or anything of that like that, but like I really, it upsets me when things are wrong and people just don't care to be fair in any way. Like some, like the thing I like can fail or lose and I can live with that, but like fixing the game itself, it gets a really visceral reaction from me. I almost feel like it's like an acidic feeling in my mouth and my stomach. It's really upsetting.
That's interesting. We'll be right back with more Shane Torres.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
And we're back with Shane Torres. So there's three of these types of jokes in it, but I'll focus on this one, which is the, I know he looks like a Hot Topic manager moonlighting at a Fridays, where you describe him and then you go like, but he didn't do anything wrong. Did you have like a variety of examples where you just sort of like,
oh God, dude, I went through a slew of those things. That was the easy part of the joke. You know, like I know I had more, but it was also kind of like always just like a 1-2 punch kind of combination of things he looked like. And I must have wrote a dozen of them, and then those were the three I liked the best that also felt different enough.
Yeah, it's like a little roast joke where it's like you're aware he's silly. And like almost to a point where it's like he's aware he's silly.
That doesn't
mean he's a criminal.
You don't put that shit on by accident.
Yeah.
Like he is an intentional man. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think probably in everything he does. So I would assume that he didn't just end up with 100 t-shirts with, you know, that are black and gray and, you know, like have like tribal design on them.
Yeah. And then, so then you do the, which is, I love when comedians do it. I mean, it's hard because I think everyone loves when comedians do it too, which is the sort of, you yell, what else has he done? And then you off mic scream, so glad you asked. The off mic scream is, it's a powerful tool in the tool belt, but talk about deciding time for the off mic scream.
I felt like I didn't want to just do like when someone does kind of a listing of the same joke over and over in a bit, like the same kind of punchline, like it always kind of like taps me out. Mm. Like I didn't like that. And I was like thinking to myself, like, well, what is a way to break this up, but not necessarily like halt all the momentum of it?
Yeah. I mean, there's jokes as we said, like true jokes in it. And but it like, it transitions a bit into like a persona joke, which is like what I think what's so great about it, which is like at first it's the idea that's great, and then you have these funny things you say, but then it's like now we're just like watching this guy who seems to really care about this person no one has thought about.
I get I mean, there's nothing more gratifying than being right when everyone else is wrong, so maybe that was part of it. Maybe it's a little self-serving to me, like I just wanted a little high from it.
Tell me about how the Anthony Bourdain part evolved into it. What did Anthony Bourdain represent to you? How did that come to be part of this joke as well?
I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but I will. Sure. A little, I guess. I remember, like, I was watching his show, and I was like, I get it. He's interesting, and he's cool, and he's, like, he's a handsome guy, and all this kind of stuff. And I had friends who, I worked in the restaurant industry for years, people who read his vocals, Kitchen Confidential or whatever. And they were like, oh, it's so compelling. He's, you know, he's like on drugs and all this stuff and he's cooking. I was like, you're a cook and you're on drugs all the time. I don't find you compelling at all. I just thought sometimes on his show, he came off like he thought he was very funny mm-hmm. when he would make jokes. And it irritated the shit out of me. And then the way the same people who call themselves foodies and like Anthony Bourdain were just, they always happened to be the same person who would shit on Guy Fieri and not like walking around a mall or what, you know, yeah. Like I hate too cool because it's never funny. It's usually not as compelling, a person or topic to me or band, or I'm not absorbing it as it seems interesting on the surface. And then a lot of the time it's bullshit. But that being said, like somebody being a sweet person, like Guy Fieri seems to be, I'm not ever really disappointed in someone being sweet.
Yeah.
Like, but I am disappointed in a person who like will be like, oh, like they seem cool. I bet they have good taste in music. And then they have like one album I like to listen to and the rest of it's horseshit or whatever. If that makes sense.
Yeah. It was something when preparing for the interview, having known this part of the joke, it reminded me of sometimes how you talk about growing up and how there are like a lot of tough guys around. And you were like this sweet, sweet guy and like how toughness was coded as cool. Do you feel like there's part of that in there, which is sort of like either a natural aversion to sort of that type of like leather jacket cool?
I don't know if there's like a natural aversion. Mm-hmm. There's a thing, I guess, like with Guy Fieri, he seems to be genuinely likes what he likes mm-hmm. and does the things he does. And then like with a lot of people who like look like Bourdain seem to me like this is fashionable. And a lot of people who were absorbing him, God rest him, were kind of that way too. Like it's like, do you even take the time to enjoy this or do you just have a Pixies t-shirt?
Yeah.
So I think I wouldn't say I have like a natural aversion to it, but I want to give everyone a shot.
Yeah.
You know, but like a lot of times that kind of persona will turn me off. I want to find somebody interesting and not pretending to be interesting.
Well, I guess it's, I'm trying to think, I mean, like, I don't know if I'd be like, oh, your comedy is like the Guy Fieri of comedy and not the Anthony Bourdain of comedy. But like, I guess they are, they have, like, I don't think I would call you the Guy Fieri of comedy. Like whatever Guy Fieri represents, it's like, it just like does not hold true because in my head, a Guy Fieri of comedy would be like, big partying and like fireworks and like that'd be cool.
Yeah.
But like, do you feel like as a creator there was something about what Guy represented that you wanted to aspire to more than what Anthony represented.
Yes. I think there's part of that because, like, I'm sure Anthony Bourdain did some very decent things in his life, so I'm not going to, like, presume to know anything about that. But, like, the part I like in the joke, as far as point making goes, was the part where I say he helps small businesses all the time.
Yeah.
Which is a real thing. I've no restaurants in Portland he went to that would just, anytime they did a rerun, it would be busy again. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like this very, like, anybody who, like, is cool and, like, liberal and, like, likes interesting music and has tattoos would want to support a small business.
Yeah.
And that is a thing. He's not saying it, he's doing it. So like, and he's not showing it, he's actually doing it, which is much more valuable than being a mouthpiece. And I'm not saying Bourdain was that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, the proof is always in the pudding. So I liked that about him.
Just in case there's, like, Anthony Bourdain heads who are, like, screaming, I do want to just note, as a fan of both, I do think... One, Anthony Bourdain, as he got older, became much more gentle and less worried about playing the character he created in the book. And I think the show reflected that. I think the early show, as like anyone who creates their first TV show, like, I imagine he's like, this guy from this book, and it's going to be like rock and roll, and he had to like buy into that. But as he got more clout, I think he did... become, he still was like, you know, leather jacket, judo, wearing Rolling Stones t-shirts, but like it was much more sentimental. And I think especially like he would, when he ate at in foreign countries with like families, he was very much a very good listener. I think that became and became less about him like cracking wise, which I think was a big part of the early show.
And he was like a bit more present and which is something I can actually appreciate. You also learn to do that better the further along you go in your life.
Yeah. And there's a side note where I feel like Guy Fieri, his also like, I think he learned how to, if you want, as a fan of the show, as I've watched it evolve, he's learned to like not dumb down how he talks to people as much. Like, I think at first he just was like being exciting nonstop. And I think he's like, sunk in and like actually is able to sort of have more earnest conversations about
as opposed to being like in your face, I'm Guy Fieri, you know, like, sell it or whatever.
But back to the joke, at different parts in the joke, because on the album and in Conan you do at different times, but you at both times you do am I still doing this or I am still doing this bit, which is a nice calling out the, as I say, like the joke becomes about sort of your flights of fancy or whatever your obsession with this is, or is it a thing where you're just sort of feeling out of like, when is the audience most backing away a little bit or most being like, how do you feel when it's time to sort of say like, oh, I also know this is a weird amount of this to do.
This is a ton of energy to put into such a thing. If no one had ever thought of it, it probably wouldn't matter. I guess in the later version of the bit, I saw how much chicken I'd chewed off the bone already, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, maybe this is a lot, but I don't want the bit to be over. So I was like, well, here's a second helping or whatever. Yeah. You know, like, is it, like, I wanted more, but I wanted to acknowledge that I may be being a bit of a zealot.
I mean, I think it also allows you to then do the last part, which is like, you know, a true flight of fancy of imagining this World War II scenario, which it's I mean, like, it's part of like what I love about this joke is that there's like so many different types of ways of approaching this joke. And you've decided to do all of them in this one joke, which is like a very Guy Fieri way of doing the joke, which is like, oh, if I'm going to prepare this dish, I'm going to do all ways of doing this.
Yeah, it's gonna have jalapenos and habanero peppers or whatever. Yeah.
Talk about adding that last flourish.
I feel like the joke, it kind of works in three parts. Mm-hmm. Like there's like the beginning and the introduction, and then there's the part of me listing and comparing the two, which is at the center of the joke. And then at the end, I was like, well, that can't, like, there's got to be another way to end this.
Yeah.
by the way, just going over this joke with you just is making me realize how much time I wasted on this joke. Like trying to work. I love it, but like it's just like I spent hours.
I thought you were going to say the opposite. I thought you were going to be like, just talking about it makes me really proud of how much work I put into it.
I am proud of it, but I'm also just like, World War II scenario. Just...
Was that a first thought? How did you get to World War II? That's such a jump that I think it's what... Yeah, I mean, it's like, I have... It is, yeah. Well, how did you get there?
I can't exactly recall.
Mm-hmm.
What brought that scenario to my brain, I kind of think my grandfather was in World War II. He was at D-Day. Mm. And I have a picture of him when he was in the war, not at D-Day, but when he was in the war. And he's like, I feel like maybe I was looking at him like, what would it be like to be like, and then like, you know, you kind of like, let's put him in a scenario.
Yeah.
And what, like what, where one will shine, the one I want to shine can shine. And the one I don't want to shine can come out the way I want them to come out as well. that also could be a complete fabrication in my mind.
The part that I forgot until re-listening is that you have Guy Fieri die on the beach.
Do I? What do I say?
You say, and he knows he's dying on that beach that morning, but he's there fighting.
Yeah, I feel... I do remember that. That is funny.
That is funny. So, I think there's dark notes in your comedy throughout, but like they do sneak in, I would say. Like I would not call you a dark comedian, but they're like you have a sneaky darkness. And I think through that part, and I think also using the imagery of Mean to Dogs were both sort of like sinister elements. Is that a thing that's important to you? You think that's just sort of natural to you?
The darkness in my act?
Yeah.
I guess I think it is. Like I think maybe early on I was kind of in my career, I mean, and in creating my comedy, I felt like maybe I was trying to be dark.
Mm.
And then like, as I've kind of moved forward now, if it's funny and it's dark, I have no problem saying it. Like as long as it's funny. But, I really hope it's just, as far as like darkness in my comedy goes, it's seen as not being dark for the sake of being dark, but which I think when I was a much younger comic, it was. But now I just hope it's like truthful in a way that's not cheesy, I guess, you know, like, or doesn't come like, cause a lot of people are like, oh, that's like the thing you always read when someone gets interviewed about a new special or whatever they're putting out. They're like, oh, this one's a lot more personal. You're like, fucking, here we go. You're going to talk about your cat. Like, it's a trope. I think an audience can feel when you're actually being personal in a bit and truthful and not just putting it out there like you are, you know, like, yeah, I sincerely believe people pick up on that.
Well, I think it's the difference between truth. You know, I mean, he's the example I was up, which is like Louis C.K. defined truth. Everyone would talk about how truthful Louis C.K. was. And it like obviously revealed to be not necessarily the case, but somewhere got lost where it's like, oh, if truthful meant you're just saying the truth on stage, where I think the distinction you're making is essentially like emotional honesty and like artistic honesty, which is sort of like you're being true to who you are. And like that means giving the audience whatever amount of your perspective as it is and like being true to your tone and, oh, I'm going to be like this and there's darkness, but ultimately it's going to be this much, not just being like this monolith of what truth is, which is like a person on stage, like telling you like gross stuff about themselves, just to like where there's no actual sort of like emotional or creative truth behind it.
Yeah. There's just the thing you did.
Yes.
A lot of people call truth in their comedy just the thing they did, which is true, but you might as well just watch a black and white video camera security footage. Yeah. It's not truthful to me if there is no emotional weight in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, sometimes that can lead to being darker as a comic. Yeah.
So I want to talk about the sort of react as those club owners mentioned, the reaction to the joke. So I will now enter the story of this joke. I don't remember if I told you, but so I first saw this joke in the fall of 2016 when you were opening for Kyle Kinane, and I was watching you, and I was like,
was that the Bowery?
Is that Caroline's?
Okay.
I remember being like, oh, it'll be interesting to see Kyle do Caroline's. I just sort of like didn't expect it.
I remember, this is like one of my favorite memories in comedy. Our buddy Gilbert Long was open, and it's at Caroline's in the middle of Times Square. He just comes in and he goes, what are we drinking tonight, boys? Olive Garden or Applebee's? Like, it's, I don't know why, but it sticks out in my memory for the rest of my life.
And so I remember seeing you do this joke for the first time, and I must have sent myself an email after Kyle, because I didn't, which was like, remember whenever Shane releases an album to ask to do an exclusive on the Guy Fieri joke.
That's very flattering. Thanks, man.
I was like, this joke is going to be such a big deal. I knew it immediately. This was like almost a full year before anything happened. I was like, this joke is going to be huge. And so like eventually I get an email from your publicist just announcing the album existing. And I'm like, is the Guy Fieri joke on it? Can we do an exclusive? Immediately. Thank you, man.
That's really cool. Seriously. I really appreciate that.
So, and I played it for everyone. Like I played it because we premiered it on Vulture and our food blog Grub Street at the same time. Because like, this is going to be, I was like, this is going to go viral. I know it. And I've never had that.
Word said a guy with an ice bucket over his head.
I know. I was like, I've been doing this too long. I know this is going to be huge. And so we put it online, and like, from my perspective, it did. Like the idea that like an album premiere track, like that it wasn't even the video clip, got passed around as much as it did. I mean, like, I can't think of tons of examples where like a thing really blew up online like that. So this was like the summer of 2017. Can you talk about what it was like for you?
Yeah. Well, I remember we'd shot the half hour and done the album, like all pretty close together. And they were like, it's finally coming out. I think it was like maybe August.
Yeah.
When that happened. And, I was like, oh, it's going up today. God, I really like, and we had spent like this money on the publicist to get it out to people, you know? And I was like really very worried. Just because it was like my first things I was putting out there that would be like forever consumable or whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. And I did think it would do well, but I was like, what if it fucking doesn't? And you're an idiot. And I remember I was in LA. I was already living in New York, but I was in LA, and my friend Adam and I, who was the floor manager at my home club in Portland. And he had moved to LA and now he's in like show business shit. We had to go to San Francisco because his girlfriend's a wonderful comic, and we were both on Outside Lands. Mm-hmm. Amy Miller.
Got it.
And he was like, I'm not flying. And I was like, what? And he goes, let's just take a bus. And we were on a bus all the way up to San Francisco from LA when it dropped, and my phone was going fucking nuts. Everybody was like texting, and I was getting all these pings and all this kind of shit. And we were laughing like lunatics on like a shitty Bolt bus or whatever. And everybody was like looking at us like, what the fuck? Like this guy goes, why are you guys laughing so much? What's going on? it was a very exciting kind of, and then I remember like, oh, it was like, yeah, I'm also like, I'm big on the internet right now. And I'm also on a bus, like being pretty upset about it. And then, I did Outside Lands, and it was like the coolest thing ever. And then I remember I came back to LA and I was doing a set at the Laugh Factory, like the following Monday or Tuesday. And I got in an Uber pool when you could still do that. And this girl goes, that was in the car, she goes, are you the Guy Fieri comic? Like, and I was like, yeah. She goes, that was funny, but he fucking sucks. And I was just like, well, it doesn't matter. Like, like you can win. Yeah, like that's the two things I take from that. Like specifically remembering is like that. One was like, oh, this kind of a great thing is happening, and I'm not going to be on this bus much longer. I'll have a life, you know. Mm-hmm. And then also, you can hold the truth up to people's faces, but they probably won't look at it.
It's interesting that you say that, because like, I feel like regardless of that person, like the public opinion of, at least as time passed, the public opinion from when you started that joke, maybe 2015, 2016, to like where it is now yeah. completely different. Like,
yeah.
And
he
I imagine
owes me money. He owes me money.
I
really feel like his publicist should cut me in on the check. Like, but then also, why should he? I just said the good things he did. Like, yeah. So, like, what's this? None of my fucking business. Keep going. I'm sorry, dog.
No, it is something of like, and I imagine if you have a Google alert to your name, like, there were no defenses of Guy Fieri before yours. Now it's like a legitimate, like, if you look up, like, defense Guy Fieri, your name will come up in like 9 million essays about Guy Fieri being good. And I bring it up because I was telling you before this, like, I think about this joke more than any other joke, like, of the last 5 years. And,
thank you.
And I'll explain why, which was specifically, I was looking, and that Caroline show was the Saturday after the 2016 election.
I remember. Because Kyle and I were so bummed. Yeah, and everybody in Brooklyn looked like they were broken up with the night before.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I was like, I don't know. I was like, oh, I guess I'll go see, like, you know, Kyle's one of my favorite comedians. Like, maybe that'll make me feel better. Or maybe I was like, oh, maybe I will like see how comedians are adjusting to this sort of new reality. And it's interesting because, and there's something I want to talk about, which is sort of like, I imagine as a comedian for the last 4 years, you've done enough interviews where people probably ask you some version of, like, you know, what is comedy's role against Trump? And what do you think about political comedy? And when I am in those conversations as well, I think about your joke, partly because because of the timing, but like, to me, it's like what satire can do. Like, I don't think of you didn't think of this joke as like a grand piece of satire or whatever, but like,
no. This
is what comedy does, which is shines a light on an issue, gives people a new framework of seeing something, and sort of provides them vocabulary of how to talk about it. And I feel like it is the most effective version of what comedy potentially can do, like, I've ever seen. Partly because you said, like, Guy Fieri is now, like, a completely different person.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
thank
it's,
you.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't even know what my question is. Do you feel like you, as a person who, like, like, to me, this is a political joke because it's about goodness in some ways and how we value people.
Yeah, it's
and
like a public consciousness kind of.
Yeah. I mean, how do you feel about this joke? And it relates to sort of the years since, as sort of like what your role is. Like, does what I say resonate to sort of what you're hoping for with your comedy?
Yes. The joke, there's it's kind of an emotional thing for me. Mm-hmm. On several, one of it being, and I've been having this talk with myself a lot lately, is that I want to make, I want to make comedy that people call art.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
And, I believe it is. And I wanted to elicit like laughter as like but I want it to be an emotional like response that is people that is thoughtful, you know? And like, I think very few comics can do that, you know? Like, and I do believe, there's a few people I could list and say like that. I think Chappelle makes art with his comedy. And mm-hmm. I think Maria does that as well. And I think I really think Louis did it for a while too, despite all the stuff he has done and, you know, whatever people think of him. So I want to be able to do that too. And that kind of leads to the other version. The other way I feel about this joke is that I hope this isn't the only time I do it, you know, like on a scale like this. I don't want to be a, you know, there's some bands that are great, but they're only a one hit wonder.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't, you know, like, I know, like, you guys know who Shane Torres is. And I know the thing they say is, oh, he's the Guy Fieri. He did the Guy Fieri. Like, I know that's the first thing.
Yeah.
And it's not that I'm not proud of it, but I want people to be like, you know, his first one was great, but his second one was even better. You know, like his second splash was bigger than the first, or, you know, like there's more to it. Like, and I'm a fan of one hit wonders, bands like who happen to be amazing and they just never made a second splash. So I think that's part of it too. Is that I feel, not like I'm very proud of the joke and I'm so happy I wrote it. So happy it's done so well. And I get defensive of it, when I see some guy literally steal it and put it on TikTok and get 400,000 views, which is a thing that happened like 2 weeks ago. It's fucking
like
livid.
He redoes the joke. Like he was
drunk, laying in a door jam on the ground. And he's like kind of being a skeptical. And like, he doesn't like lip sync it, but he like just does the whole bit and his friends are laughing. And I'm like, Doug's the funniest. And I'm like, fuck Doug. Like, I hate him. But then, you know, I think the good thing is that that joke is in the ether so much that no one will think he, you know, like if you, like, it's my, like I, it's mine or whatever, you know, it's like, but he's like literally doing my shit and these people are like laughing and losing their fucking minds. And I'm like, God damn it. Like I think I kicked my chair over and it's like, over what? Yeah. So I have like, I guess I have a lot of different emotions about the joke.
Yeah. What was Guy's response? Or continued response?
He tweeted at me.
Yeah.
He tweeted at me and he like had a little meme. That was cool. And we were laughing. And then he actually called me. I was on a flight and it was so funny. I've been flying a bunch for years, but I'd never been upgraded to first class. And I literally got put in first class and he called me as the flight was pushing back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cool, man, because he called me and knew, I didn't know. I thought it was like an LA number and I thought like maybe it's somebody I work with or something.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, is Shane there? And I was like, who's calling? And he goes, Guy. And I'm like, who? And he goes, it's Guy Fieri. And I just started fucking laughing really, really loud. And I was like, what's up, man? And the guy next to me was a suit and tie businessman drinking scotch. And I was just like, oh, hey, how are you? And he's like, I'm good. And he goes, hey, I just wanted to call and say thanks. And he was like, keep kicking ass. And we got a lot to talk about. And he's like, call me after your flight lands and all this kind of stuff. And then I called him and he never got back to me. But I think that, but it was cool. You know, like I sincerely appreciate that the guy's moving mountains all the time, like with his businesses and like that fundraising thing he did at the start of the pandemic for restaurant workers and shit. You know, so guy that busy calling me for 3 minutes just because I did some dumb wisecrack is pretty, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. On this podcast, Patton Oswalt was on and I asked him, like I do all my guests.
Biggest moment, dog. Yeah, that was a huge win for me.
Let me ask the question. what? Yeah, so I asked him, what is the joke?
Like, what do you fucking think of this scumbag Shane Torres?
Yeah. So I asked him, what is the joke that he wish you could steal? You know, not steal, but it's another dimension where everything's the same, but you have this joke, essentially. What's just the joke you wish you wrote? And Patton said this joke. And then when I had him back on the podcast, I was like, is there any other joke that you wish you wrote? He goes, nope, still Shane Torres' Guy Fieri joke.
That's
what?
Awesome.
How does that make you feel?
Yeah, it blew me away, man. I know Patton a little bit now, you know, like we're friendly, and I've opened for him on a couple of different occasions and stuff. I mean, I hold him in such a really high regard, like Feeling Kind of Patton is one of the albums he put out. I listen to that all the time. What was the other one? Werewolves and Lollipops.
Yeah.
Is one of his albums. I remember I listened when I lived in Portland, I got that album and I was sitting in a coffee shop, like a diner or something in the middle of the night listening to it. I bought it on a CD. And I was listening to it and he was doing that Brian Dennehy joke or that story he tells. And I fucking like started choking on my pancakes. I was laughing so hard. And this guy next to me was like, he's like, that's okay. He's like, you got to let that joy out, man. And so, I mean, that's what I mean. It's huge, you know, like Patton is fucking, you know, like I want to have a career like his in a lot of ways. I think he's so special. Like it's Billy Gardell said about Patton. He said he's the bridge between the alt world of comedy and like what we would consider mainstream. Like, I think he's the person, you know, he's like kind of like, he can play anywhere and he can do any kind of room. You know, he's that brilliant. Like there's not, he can play outside of, he doesn't have a zone where he's not comfortable. Patton's incredible. Mm-hmm. He's pretty special.
So does hearing him say that, is it useful as a reminder? Like, I mean, it's like doing stand-up is hard. Is it useful to be like, well, I know I did this correct. Like, is it the sort of thing that you, it helps push you forward?
Yes. When someone great tells you something that flattering, or you hear, you know, in my case, through a podcast, it's, yeah, you know, it's like somebody you idealize in a lot of ways, you know, like, I was reading about Jack White's subtle, like his tribute to Eddie Van Halen on the SNL this past weekend.
Yeah.
Cause the guitar was Eddie designed for him and stuff. It's like, you know, it's amazing. Like who gets that? Like very few people get that at all, you know, like, and I got a little bit of it from Patton, you know, so that's it's special. I don't know where you put it in your head. There's no physical representation of it. It's just there and pretty amazing to look at. Like it's or absorb. I messaged him on Twitter and told him thank you, and he wrote back and it was really nice. And then you know, and then the other thing was, I remember in that episode Patton said it would either be my joke or Gary Goldman's state abbreviation bit. Mm-hmm. And then I saw Gary at the Cellar. He's like, hey, how about us? which made me pretty happy because that means I'm in good company, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so funny. That sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It is like a lightning round, but it's a laughing round. Because it's a comedy.
I'm with you. I know what you're related. I don't know if I would have grasped this concept if I wasn't an avid listener to the show.
If every guest somewhat gets it, but then ultimately they're like, oh, it's still just asking. He's still just going to ask me a question and then I answer it.
So. Yeah. Has anyone ever been just like, I'm sorry, what are we doing?
I think that anyone who doesn't get it is too polite to be like, wait, no, please explain exactly what you mean. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, they're not going to have the gall of Eddie Pepitone to just be like, what are you talking about?
No. So I'll ask it out of order, but so I'll ask this question first, which is usually not my first laughing around question, but is there a joke you wish you could steal? Not steal, but it's another dimension where everything's exactly the same, but you have this comedian's joke. So, you know, no one will be mad at you. You just sort of have this joke, the joke you wish you thought of. Is there such a joke for you?
Yeah. Can I say two? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Well, there was one, this is true. There was a guy in Portland when I started comedy there and he was like 50 years old and his name was Sean Connery. And he had this bit and it is, by the way, I thought about this segment of the show a lot. I was really like, I'm like, I'm so serious. But Sean had this joke. This sounds mean. And my favorite thing is a comedian who is not that great with one brilliant joke. Mm. Always like, it's like, I don't know. It's like putting your spoon in pudding and then finding out there's cherries at the bottom. Like I just love it so much, but he had this bit where he would go, my stepdad, he was this horrible drinker. And I remember one night he came home and he was so boozy and smelly. I could smell him through my bedroom door. And I was like 14 years old and I was in my underwear. And I stood up in front of my sister's door and I said, you're not going in there tonight. And he punched me in the nose. There's blood everywhere. And he took off his belt, and I have scars on my legs to this day from when I was a boy. This guy beat the shit out of me with his belt. My mother was screaming and my sister was crying because I guess you just had to be there. And I fucking love that joke so much. Like, I'm so envious of it. I'll never get to say it like on stage into a microphone, which makes me sad, but it's so fucking beautiful. And then the other one is, I don't know if you knew him, but there's a comedian named Richard Vane.
No, I'm not sure.
I started with him in Portland, and he was like the funniest person ever. He opened for Patton at the first Bridgetown when we decided to have a local So he was like the funniest guy, and he died this year. I just get sad because I don't hear his jokes anymore. But one of my favorite ones was, it's so gross. And if you want to cut this and it offends everybody, and I'm really sorry. He goes, I read due to overfishing and pollution, there might not be seafood in 20 years. And that really sucks because how's a guy going to describe stinky pussy to his friends? He goes, I fucked this skank last night. It smelled like, he goes, I don't know what it smelled like. And I miss him so much. And I miss that joke a lot. I wish those two killed me. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite joke, like a street joke?
I don't know. I remember one time I told my mom my aunt lost weight, and she said, what'd she do? Take off her shoes. And I thought that felt like the structure of a street joke. Yeah. That's about it.
Yo mama joke. Your mom lose weight when she takes off her shoes.
Yeah. So that would be Jesus. Yeah. So you should get out there. That was pretty quick.
Do you have a comedy crush, a person whose comedy you have a crush on, not a person in comedy you have a romantic crush on?
I like, Joe Pera.
Yeah.
It's so different. You know, I like watching people who do things I don't do. Like as a comedian, you know, like you are very different. I think there's a comic in New York named Dina Hashim,
mm-hmm.
who is, I think she just writes brilliant stuff.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, those are two people I just can keep watching forever.
All right. So last one.
Okay.
Do you have a joke that has never worked or rarely worked that you worked really hard on that you thought this is the funniest thing, but audiences never bought into it, but you'll go to your grave being like, this was funny. They were wrong.
Yeah, I do. I actually, I was trying to write a bit about what it was like to be the first undercover cop. And I tried it, and actually the Portland Mercury actually wrote a piece about me trying to make the joke work over and over again. But yeah, that was like, I was like, I would do these things. Like I would do these like big long act outs, which isn't typically like a big staple in my act,
yeah.
You know? And then like the twist in the bit was like, he's like very bad at being it because no one's ever done it before. So he like answers in cop jargon to like, yeah, like a, you know, like a fairly offensive Italian stereotype of a gangster.
Sure.
And, you know, and then the big twist at the end was like, what would it be like to be the first criminal busted by the first undercover cop? Which was like, you know, like, I thought we were friends. Like, I told you shit I've never told anybody. Because even though they're a criminal and they're wrong, like the sense of betrayal has to be pretty profound for that guy.
Like never even heard of the possibility that they might be tricked.
And it like worked into this big dragged out thing of like, oh, good one, Steve. Like when they're putting him in the cop car and like cuffing him and stuff. Like you're taking this a bit too far. That was like I always thought that was because the way I would intro the bit was be like, I think it's interesting the first time anyone tries something brand new. I was like working on that bit forever. And then I tried to do, I was in Vermont years ago, and I was featuring for Dana Gould, and I was kind of working the bit into a different, like, maybe the analogy is not right. And I was like, you're supposed to scare a bear away by waving and yelling at it. And I was like, who was the first guy to try that?
Then
Dana had a version of the same idea, and his was, of course, 10,000 times better. And then I was just like, well, fuck this. And so I so I'll try and get the cop one to work someday.
Yeah, I think it's great. Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, like, you talking about it's good. I mean, I imagine it's a different experience when it's like 10 minutes of like you doing to the different voices.
Eating my own nuts. Yeah, it's pretty fucking horrible.
But I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a thing that would work.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like it, you know. Howard Hughes made it sound like the spruce goose was going to fly. Yeah.
That's it. That's the interview. Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you, man. I really was looking forward to this. I really appreciate it. I love the show. Thanks for having me.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can listen to Shane's album, Established 1981, wherever you stream music. Follow Shane on Twitter at Shane Torres and on Instagram at Syrup Mountain. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Hannah Rosen, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week. Have a good one.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Teen Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Teen Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.